Okay, all flight controllers, go, no go for landing. Retro.
Go,
I
don't go.
Titan, go.
GNC,
go.
Econ,
go.
Control,
go.
Ninth Planet Audio.
Capcom, we're go for landing.
Welcome to Turek Books Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm your host, Joshua Turek. We're never going to read all the books we want, but when someone tells us about a book, that's its own valid form of experiencing it. Our guests come in to talk about the books that left lasting marks on them as readers, and that becomes a springboard to who they are, who I am, and maybe who all of us are. So sit back, relax, and enjoy it. And who knows, maybe you'll end up grabbing a book or two. Maybe you've read some of them and it's nice to hear someone else talk about them. We want this to be like a book club, but without the guilt. Thank you for tuning in to the Turek Books Podcast. We're really excited for our guest today. She's an Emmy-nominated writer, Ellery Smith. Thank you for joining us.
Oh my God, thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Good. Happy to have you. You were just saying that you do mark your books.
Yeah, I do.
A divisive thing in the book world, markers versus non-markers.
So. I guess that's true. Not like library books, but books I own.
Yeah, you mark the library book.
Some people do that.
They do, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've returned books. So I've heard people say they treasure getting used books that have been marked because it's like a guide for them. And to me, it's an aberration. But we're all different.
So the thing about getting a used book that somebody has marked in is then sometimes you see people who have underlined really stupid things.
Right.
And so it's interesting to see like what something means to somebody else.
You're like, the person who had this book before me was not my kind of person.
Yeah, and maybe.
I gotta lower this.
Or like I had gotten a like a therapy style workbook and it had but I bought it used and it had been half filled in.
Uh-oh.
Exactly.
Like, oh, exactly. She was going through it.
Yeah. So, but either it really worked or she just gave up.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, true. Like met someone new, like halfway through. Like, oh, yeah, I don't need to do this. I'll work on the self-help next crisis, but I'm feeling pretty good.
Yeah, maybe she would have gotten back to it. Who knows?
Yeah, it looks like you have a nice, healthy stack of books here today. I really appreciate you bringing them.
I do have a healthy
them.
Stack. I was told that Amy Silverberg brought 10 books, but that seems like an exaggeration, so I thought that this amount was okay.
Yeah, I think Amy brought like five.
Five?
Yeah.
But some are, all the George Saunders books are short stories, and I like flagged my favorite story in each.
Oh, cool.
So we're not talking about the whole book, you know?
Oh, cool. Yeah, no, I mean, if you're looks like you're flowing on one theme with an author, that's like, yeah, how do you limit yourself? So what do you bring us here?
I'm thinking about what I want to start with, but we'll just start with the top. The first book is a book called Islands of Abandonment, which I read like October of last year, and it is really interesting. It's about places in the world that have been abandoned by humans, and it's like about nature rebounding in the post-human landscape. That's the subtitle. And it's this girl, and she goes to like Chernobyl. She goes to this like really toxic field in France where like a war, it was like the most shelling in any war. And she goes to some places in New Jersey. So she basically examines these landscapes that were once inhabited by people but are no longer. And so nature is taking back over, which is really interesting.
Really interesting.
Yeah. And I think it really hit for me because my hometown is very small and most people have left, and so it's very derelict, and a lot of the buildings have been retaken by nature. And so I think I read this at a time where I was like really thinking about how my hometown is sort of disappearing, but it's not disappearing, it's just being reclaimed by nature.
Right.
Yeah.
And this book lent you that additional perspective to think of your hometown that way?
It made it like sort of okay or better.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think before, there's still a lot of grief wrapped up in that, but now I think this book gave me like the point of view where I can be more accepting of it and not feel so like hurt, I guess.
Really?
Yeah.
Hurt. Like, so you've seen in your hometown a vast change even from when you were growing up to now?
Yeah. I mean, when I was growing up there, it was still small, but now it's like empty. Like,
really?
Yeah. There's no coffee shop. There's like no stoplight, you know?
Whoa.
There are people who there like are no kids, basically. Yeah.
Where is this?
Rural New York.
Okay.
Like really rural New York.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. And so this book found you for a real resonant reason.
Yeah, I think it really, really hit for me. And that was like, it was a very emotional read.
Yeah, well, we're living with this like constant ecological anxiety, right?
Yeah.
And we're all trying to find ways to sort of like tend to it in the moment that isn't just totally like dread.
Yeah.
And you know, it's like the George Carlin joke of like, Earth is going to be fine. You know, we talk about the world ending. Earth will be fine. It's people who are, you know, it's up for debate.
It's also interesting because it's sort of like, I know a lot of people whose hometowns have been expanded or like built up. And there's a grief in that.
Right.
We're like, oh, now everything is new. There's more people. There's like a mall, whatever. But I'm experiencing the opposite.
The opposite. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, and those childhood things are so like big, you know?
Yeah.
It's like.
And to watch it just all be sort of like abandoned.
There used to be a toy store there. Or the opposite of like, there used to be a ditch I played in over there, and now
there's
a building.
Full of concrete, yeah.
Yeah.
I also think, you know, my dad died when I was young, and I moved out of the town, and we had to sell my childhood home, and like, he was a mechanic, and the last time I went back, his shop wasn't there anymore.
Damn.
Or like, only part of it was, and I was like, okay, next time I come back, it's going to be gone for real. That was tough. And so, like, I think the book was good for me, and sort of understanding the natural cycle of all that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so nature does kind of, like in Chernobyl, I think, don't they talk about how like wildlife has become abundant?
Yeah, exactly.
And there aren't people there because it's a kind of gated, protected disaster zone or whatever.
So there's no one there to like wreck it. And there's also a really beautiful part of this book where she goes to an island in Scotland, I think, and she sort of follows this like herd of wild cows, and one of the cows dies, and the other cows come back to the body every day until the bones are so fragile that they end up trampling over it. But even then, it's like absorbed by the earth, and it becomes something else that the cows can go visit. And it's like very,
wow,
yeah,
jeez Louise.
No, but it's good. It's sort of like very beautiful and cyclical.
Absolutely.
And it's like no building is forever, and in the same breath, every building is forever because it will just become something else. It's like the sediment. It's the dirt.
Yeah, yeah, to take us back into the natural cycle of things.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Yeah, what a spellbinding introduction.
Really good. Recommended to me by your manager.
Really?
Our close friend.
Of course.
Some might say.
He's got great book taste. When someone when their book recommendations land with you, it's like a different feeling for sure.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. The next book is Joan Didion's The Year of Magical Thinking. Which is good. I actually read this recently. I'm a big fan of hers, and I had been avoiding this book because it's about the death of her husband.
Yeah.
And there were a few years, there were like 5 years after my dad died where I couldn't read anything about grief.
Yeah.
Because the year my dad died, my grandpa died, and a friend of mine killed himself,
okay.
Which is not funny, but in a way it is funny. And so for a long time I had it was tough for me to interact with media about grief, and then this year I was like, all right, I'm ready. So this book is about how her daughter is in the hospital in a coma. In a medical coma, and she gets home from visiting, her and her husband get home from visiting her daughter in the hospital, and her husband has a heart attack and dies. And so now her husband's dead, and she's making the funeral plans, and her daughter is still in a coma, and so the daughter doesn't wake up for like another few weeks, and then when she wakes up, she's like, where's dad?
And dad's dead.
And dad's dead.
Okay.
And so it's about like this year where she keeps thinking she might be able to tell her husband something, but her husband's not around anymore.
Yeah.
And so it's really good.
It's a very famous book. Everyone,
it is a very famous book.
Like, you know, I've read a lot of Joan Didion, but I think similarly I've stayed away from it for the reasons you did. Like, okay, this is a head-on confrontation of grief.
Tough.
And
lots of tears.
And Joan Didion is like so, she has such a clarity to the way she sees the world. That's like pretty close to objective in a lot of ways, but it's artfully objective.
She does have a real journalist's eye, which is like very, but applied to her own life, it's like sort of crazy how clear she can be on her in her thinking. And she wrote this, I think, the year after, or like the year of.
Wow.
And I'm like, I'm so far away from my emotions. And I'm like, I won't be able to write about that for like another 10 years probably.
Yeah, no, you're just figuring out how to cope. And how to cope isn't always conducive to like looking things straight on. Like in bringing value to other people with that.
Yeah, it very rarely is. And she like
it very rarely is.
They worked together where like she would have a sentence for something that she couldn't use, so she would give it to John, or John would write something and give it to her, and like he would edit her pieces. And so there's just such a hole in her life.
Right.
Yeah. And then her daughter gets married and there's a hole there, and it's like very...
Well, yeah, you know, we're going to talk about him, it looks like, based on your pile. But I remember in one of George Saunders' essays, I read it when I was young, he was talking about like how much he loved his wife, and that too was going to come to an end. And it was like the first time I conceived of the fact that, like, oh yeah, like, damn, that's... So like things can go well in relationships, and there's a sadness to them going well.
And I think that's why a lot of people choose not to pursue them, or they get in their own way. They like are self-sabotaging because there's grief in the existence of anything.
Right. Oh, damn. That's good. Yeah, it's that good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there really is. And it's like,
well said.
Also, for a long time after my dad died, I couldn't enjoy anything because I was like, but enjoyment will bring sadness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How old were you when that happened?
I was 23.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, really. I was 30 when my dad died.
Tough.
Yeah, yeah, tough. My joke is that it's been hard growing up without a father.
But it really is like that.
Yeah.
And there are also so many, like, conversations that you don't get to have that you wouldn't think to have until you were a certain age.
Right. That's right.
And that fucking sucks.
Well, and then there's conversations you wouldn't think to have until you've gone through the loss of that person.
Yeah.
So it's like, I couldn't have had this conversation without losing this person, but I'd like to have it with this person. But wait, I couldn't have because I had to lose them to even think this way.
Yeah.
Yeah. It messes with you.
I think in a way. And I think that's what this book is really about. It's about how she like all year long, she expected to wake up next to her husband.
Right.
And every morning it was like learning again.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you said you were finally ready to kind of get into this subject matter. And so it connected with you?
Yeah, it really connected with me. I thought it was really good. I thought it was really, really good. And I would recommend it to anybody who's experiencing a loss. But it's like, also, I think what spoke to me about it was like the 1-2 punch of like everything happening at once. So it's like when I was 23, my grandpa died. And then, you know, 4 months later, my friend killed himself. And then 4 months after that, or like 3 months after that, whatever, my dad died.
Yeah.
And then the week that my dad died, 2 of our family pets died.
Wow.
And exactly. So it was like, I was like, okay, like, where's the joke? Like, who's doing this to me? Like, what sort of cosmic plan is happening?
Yeah.
And so I think this book really spoke to me because she was just like, okay, all of these things can stop. Like at any point, enough is enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had a friend who he's a little older. He lost his dad and his dog. And he was like, the dog was worse, to be
quite honest
with you.
The dog is, I mean, kind of in a way, because you expect your parents to die. And I guess you expect your dogs to die too.
Yeah.
But like,
I need like 20 more years with my dog. And then
you have a little dog, so you might
hope,
get it.
I hope. I want to just go into the tomb with him when he goes, I'm ready to.
You could get him a plot first. And then my dad shares a headstone with his first girlfriend.
Okay. No kidding.
Yes, she died first. They got the headstone made.
No way. Yeah. And they weren't even together at
They were together when she died.
Oh, they were?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then he met my mom after.
Got it.
Yeah. But I still think a funny thing to do.
The shared headstone?
With your ex-girlfriend.
Yeah. Yeah. No, really funny thing to do. But like also you spent the money, you know?
You might as well.
Yeah, you might
I'm not going to
well.
Buy a new one. My favorite headstone like engraving is a woman and it just says wife and mother.
Simple as that.
Had nothing else went on for her.
Yeah. Well.
Or like wife of, and then it says the husband's name. And I'm like, even in death, she has to share her fucking like headstone.
The duty bound.
So duty bound.
Afterlife too.
That's funny.
Yeah, I could go on and on about that stuff.
You want to be buried in the ground?
No. Well, yeah. Like they have the option now where you do.
To be a tree?
Yeah.
That's what I want to do
too.
Yeah,
the compost.
Yeah, I think that's cool.
It's going to be messy getting to the compost state, and I mourn what will happen to this body that I've appreciated, but yeah.
But by that time.
Yeah, it's.
It'll have enough miles on it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, true, I hope.
No resale value.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, and just the idea of the tree. I used to think the ocean, and then I was like, actually, the ocean's huge, and it's not totally my home. My ancestors.
It's not your home really at all. I feel like the fish would be.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's theirs. So, yeah, I think it'd be cool if a tree
That's kind of how I feel. I think they wrap you, don't they take your ashes and they wrap you up in a little bundle? Seed bundle?
Ah,
yeah, and then they plant it and then it grows. And
they
then
sell you at Home Depot.
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably.
Right?
Yeah.
Those two books to me felt related in a cool way.
They are related in a cool way.
Yeah.
They're both about different kinds of grief.
Yeah. And using the patterns of nature as a means of understanding your place in this earth.
And what's interesting about the Joan Didion book, it's about a disruption in the natural cycle. Because it's like she feels her husband's not really old, and so she feels robbed of what maybe should have happened.
Right.
And so I get that. And then her daughter being so young and being so sick, and she's like, okay, well, your daughter's not supposed to be in a coma, and then your husband, it just feels so out of the realm of a natural pattern.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and how to deal with it.
Okay, I'm going to get into my, I don't know. Maybe let's get into the George Saunders stuff.
Let's do it.
I am a big George Saunders fan.
Okay.
Potentially his biggest fan.
Okay.
And these are three of his books. He has a bunch of books. I read them all this summer.
How was that?
It was good. I had to take a little break because he can be very dark and sort of twisted. But it was good. I'm such a big fan of his.
Did you read his nonfiction too?
I read The Brain Dead Megaphone and A Walk in the Pond in the Rain.
Yeah. Oh, you did.
A Swim in the Pond in the Rain. Yeah. Those. Speaking of glazing over, getting to the Russian short stories, that was where I was sort of all right.
Yeah.
I really started thinking my own thoughts and would have to go back and really read them.
That book took me 6 to 8 months off and on for that reason. It's so dense.
But it's good. It's
so
really good advice. It's really good advice. And I obviously am from upstate New York. I love that a lot of his stories take place in upstate New York.
Yeah, he's a Syracuse professor.
He's a Syracuse professor, and he lived there for a while. And all of his books are dedicated to his wife, Paula, more or less.
Aww.
So my favorite stories in his latest book, which is called Liberation Day, is the first one, which is also called Liberation Day. And it's about, a lot of his books have a sci-fi slant.
Yeah.
Which is totally not my thing usually. But they're very satirical and very grounded in reality. And so the namesake story, Liberation Day, is about it's so hard to explain. It's about three or four people who are strung up in this room, and they are used by other people to tell stories, to make performances. And so a lot of the dialogue in the story is about, sure, we have to live in this room and we're strung up by our arms and held up by our feet, and we don't get to talk to anybody, and they have a rave star minds, but don't we get to make art, and isn't that nice? And not everybody gets to make art, so we should be really grateful.
Mm.
Which struck me so hard as a writer, because I'm that's how I feel a lot of the work we do is about concessions. It's sure, I'm writing ads, but at least I get to write, you know?
Yeah.
Or sure, I'm training this AI machine that will replace me, but at least I get to write.
Yeah. No, I mean, spot on, in this sort of, I was telling Amy when she was on, the thing that strikes me about George Saunders is it's his nonfiction is so generous and compassionate and just thoughtful. And
his fiction is so biting.
His fiction is so what if an idiot was in a dystopia and didn't know it and kind of had a good attitude about
it? Or knew it and didn't care because he was profiting.
Right.
Yeah.
And then it's why does this connect so much? It's maybe I'm the idiot in the makings of this dystopia. And he uses extreme examples, but...
No, but they're also so real. They're so realistic. And a device he uses that we'll talk about as we get further along is the theme park as a setting. Which is on its face a little comic and silly, but it's also I've totally worked in an office where I was this place is a zoo.
Mm-hmm.
Or this is a theme park.
Right.
And the ride is using the intercom and taking the elevator up. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and the idea that everything is built as this, built with entertainment in mind, and the fun house, the fun house side of things. Everything is an experience, or everything's there to please you. You go to the mall and the music's playing and the,
but also because of that, it's so one dimensional and flat. It's
right.
Devoid of any taste or consideration, and it just sort of exists to be busy.
Right.
Yeah.
And that feeling of I want off this ride.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's what a lot of his short stories are about, are people being I want to be off the ride. So that's the first story. Really good. Very, it hits. It's a little long, but it's okay. I'm like giving him notes. The second story I like in this book is actually the second story in the book. It's called The Mom of Bold Action. And it's about this mom who's a writer who has never turned out a good short story until her kid comes home with a bum knee because some guy had attacked him on the street. And so, you know, she's talking with the kid, and then she and the husband is like useless and doesn't know how to protect the kid. And so she writes this like really beautiful, scathing story about how her husband like is a wet blanket, like doesn't have a spine. And so the husband reads the story and then goes out and finds the guy that attacked the kid and comes home and is like, I did this for us. And the wife is really happy. And then at the end of the story, they realize that he had attacked the guy's cousin.
Oh, no.
And not the guy. And so now they see this guy walking around town with a limp because the husband attacked the wrong man. And it's just such a funny, I mean, it's twisted, but it is really funny. And it's sort of about like revenge and like misappropriated emotions and, you know, just a bunch of crossed wires. It's so good.
That's so good. So many layers to that.
And it's about a bunch of different like overlapping relationships, and because it's like the way the mom feels about the kid, the way the mom feels about herself, the way that the dad feels about the dynamic, how like she doesn't respect her husband because her husband can't stand up to anybody. And then when he does try to stand up to anybody, he attacks a stranger.
Yeah, it's heart-wrenching. It's like that you talking about that makes me just think of this. Everyone feels like they need to prove themselves.
Yeah, and in the rush to prove themselves, they don't do any research. They like don't do any background work, and so then they end up attacking the wrong person or whatever.
Painful,
but like, and this is such a through line for him, but so twistedly funny.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, he makes that work. He's one of my favorite writers, George Saunders. So
I think he's so talented.
Likewise.
And I've always been curious why he never did a TV show.
I think he tried.
He did. He added like an Amazon pilot or something. But I'm like, and you know, have you seen Severance?
Yes.
That feels like his short.
Yeah,
stories.
It does. I talked to an executive who had to be the one to make the phone call to George Saunders to say your show's not going, and I was just like, God, Hollywood, man.
I mean, literally. Like, I mean, in that same breath, The Great Equalizer. But I'm like, I feel like George Saunders is not. He's not like publicly, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, no, I don't think your average person knows who George Saunders is.
Or not even that, but like, I remember I brought one of his books home in high school and my mom read it and she was like, that was dark.
Right.
And I had to be like, yeah, that's the point. So I'm like, he's not, and it's okay. And I feel like also the people he's sort of making fun of or satirizing or pointing out in a lot of these stories is like the average idiot.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So then for those people to turn around and be consuming his work, I'm like, would he even like that?
Right. Yeah, there's some quote about that. It's like, I don't know. I got like someone went through and liked a bunch of my videos, and they were like from an organization that I like feel like my videos are making fun of, and I'm like, damn, I'm not doing a good job if they're liking it.
Yeah, I mean, also satire is tricky in that way, where like if people fail to view it as a satire, it stops operating as one.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's just like their literal life. They're like, yeah, this is my perspective.
Yeah, like, exactly. But that's not your, do you know what I mean? It's like once you make the art, it's out of your hands, and like you can't be in control of how everybody interprets it.
Yeah. No, once you put that video out there, the comment section does not belong to you.
Yeah, and brother, don't theirs. I know that. It belongs to the men now. This one I'll do last.
Hey, I got trolled by a man who makes tie-dyed shirts for a living. And
that's
I was like,
sick.
What?
That's
the
no, that's
hippies
sick.
Are trolls now,
okay,
too?
Okay, but here's the thing. I didn't come up with this, but I think the hippies now are like people who were hippies are actually now like crazy libertarian or
right.
Like right-wing people.
Yeah, the meme of like hippies are mean people pretending to be nice. Punks are nice people pretending to be mean.
Sure, yeah. And then also, yeah. Like, I think the hippie movement of the 60s, like, all those people, like, grew up to create the housing crisis.
Right.
And so I was like, what is a hippie anymore?
Yeah, well, the whole theory that I got into for a second was that hippies were created by the CIA to distract from the legitimacy of the anti-war movement.
I actually do agree with that. I really agree with that. And I think that a lot of, like, these sort of counterculture, a, a lot of it was invented by the CIA to sort of detract from the real, because they'd be like, oh, well, those people don't wash their hair.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
This frilly excess is exactly. like nothing to be taken seriously.
The same
seriously.
Way that I think that PETA was invented by the meat lobby for people to take veganism less seriously.
Oh, that's spot on.
Yeah, that's a layup.
It feels
like,
spot
that makes
on.
Sense.
Yeah, it's like, why are you trying to turn me off to your messaging so hard?
So hard. It seems like very intentional, where they're like, no, you shouldn't say don't beat a dead horse because that's offensive. And you're like, I think we have bigger fish to fry.
Well, then my conspiracy is I think cows aren't even, and this is conspiracy, it's not rooted in fact, but I don't think cows are nearly as bad for the environment as we've been told. I think the fossil fuel companies were like, oh, this is a great target.
Oh,
let's
that's
just blame the cows. Like,
so like how BP invented like the idea of like your carbon footprint.
Right. Same yeah. thing. Cowspiracy. Same thing. Like what a seductive, like funny, like you're giving like body to a problem instead of like the vagaries of the fossil fuel companies. Yeah. So I think they created this whole messaging. Because then you look up the numbers and it's like, okay, cows make up X amount of methane emissions, and it's like not
but I think it's
significant.
Not just the cows alive, it's like the production of feed, it's like
the water,
watering them,
right.
It's about like butchering them and sending them out. That includes gas, and
right.
so I think it's like more the system,
the whole chain
of
it all.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
But it's a fun theory. I think there,
yeah,
there's
I wanna,
something there.
Yeah, it's
you
it's
could run with
not,
that.
Yeah, I'm not, I can't discredit it yet. Not in, like, let's wait. Couple decades and see what's going on.
Oh, by that point there won't be any cows.
Oh yeah,
it'll all be lab grown.
Yeah, it'll all just be emus and ostrich farms, and
I mean probably,
you know,
and you'll have to describe to your kid what a cow was.
Oh great. Well, that sounds very George Saunders.
It does sound very George Saunders.
And so you have a couple more
of
his
works? I have two more of his books. Like I said, I'm sort of a super fan. I just think he's,
this is great. There's plenty of super fans for George Saunders.
This next George Saunders book is called In Persuasion Nation, which is one of his best ones. I mean, they're all good. But my favorite story in here is called My Flamboyant Grandson. And it's, the title is sort of a misnomer, because it's about how he wants to take his grandson to a Broadway play. And they almost don't make it because in this world, ads pop up in front of you and you have to interact with the ad before you can keep going.
Oh, boy.
And so it's like, reading this story really is how it feels like to interact with sort of any digital service. So it's like they get to the theater for the first time. They realize they don't have the tickets they were sent are not the actual tickets. It's a receipt of tickets, and they have to go pick up the tickets downtown. So they go downtown to try to pick up the real tickets, and every single way they miss, like, they all these ads are popping up and they have to interact with them. And so they go pick up the real tickets and they turn, and like then they interact with this ad. And the grandfather tries to walk away, and he gets in trouble for not interacting with the ad. And so he gets written up in this world, and he tells his grandson to, like, go run and, like, make the show. But it's such an interesting comment on, like, the world we live in now. It really is. And it's about how, like, at every point there's some company that you have to interact with to get what you want, and they want to make everything so arduous and hard to navigate so that you will have to interact with as many of those ads as possible.
Yeah, where's the lie?
No lie at all. And that's what I think that's why it strikes me so, and this story is like truly 4 or 5 pages long. Yeah, maybe like 4 or 5 pages long. And it's I read it like every year, because every year it just becomes way more true.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's my experience on not even on the internet, but like now in real life.
Yeah. And everywhere you go.
Everywhere you go. And it's like the sort of like the touch screen generation. And like, it's a really good story.
No, it's like a hurdle we're inundated with marketing just to get to ourselves. Just to
so
go
true.
See your friend across town, you're seeing billboards. Now the buses have the ads and the flickering. They have like video ads on billboards. And it's
yeah.
like, I just literally want to go see my friend. But I've had to encounter being sold to. And it's altered our brains and our experience of what life is.
And I also think that it's interesting that everything is now advertising space. Like, there's no space that is safe from advertisers. And advertisers themselves are looking at the ways that they can colonize at literally every blank space that we have,
right?
Or something that maybe wasn't blank that they want to paint over or project on or whatever.
Yeah. Did you just see the abandoned high rises in downtown LA
yeah,
that
graffiti.
Got graffitied?
Yeah.
And it's like, to the one of the principles behind graffiti to me is reclamation of the public space.
Agree.
And it's really going, agree. Hey, this is this space belongs to all of us, so here's my expression.
And also, what's interesting about that, in a way that is very like pointedly political, is a lot of those high rises are built by foreign oligarchs or bought by foreign oligarchs as a speculative investment, and they're left empty.
Right.
And so, like, that entire building is empty, basically.
Right.
And 10 blocks away is the largest collection of unhoused people in America.
Yeah.
But our problem with it in the news is graffiti.
Is graffiti.
Yeah. And it's like that building itself is an abomination. Like, to me, that's the graffiti. That's the stain.
That's right.
Yeah.
As that huge digital billboard plays right next to the freeway.
Yes.
As people, you know, whip their cars through, you know, life and death. And yet, yeah, the graffiti, it's like this, the graffiti doesn't have commercial value.
But that's why it's a problem.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that's why it's the problem of the conversation.
But anything can be as unsightly as it wants as long as it's making money for someone. And then it's justified in its existence.
Damn. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I was just talking about that as like, you know, craftsmanship used to be how you make your money. Now it's inverse. It's like, it's not about the skill. It's just about the product.
Yeah. And it's about producing the product as many times as possible.
Yeah. Many times as quickly as and efficiently. And that's why everyone's complaining about the box apartment buildings and the box homes. It's like, it's because they build them that way to maximize space to make more money.
Yeah.
It's like putting an archway right here would look pretty, but then it over the course of the building would mean two less units, and you can't make money off of two less units or as much money. And so like that's what's affecting, you know.
And it's every sector too. It's like
every sector.
I feel like I've had this conversation a million times, but like when I was growing up, we had a vacuum that lasted 25 years, and every 3 years I have to buy a new vacuum.
Yeah.
And so now it's just like, oh, everything sucks because there's no money in a project somebody doesn't need to buy twice.
Even the things that were supposed to be obsolete, planned obsolescence, whatever, are getting worse. Speaking of dads, I inherited my dad's Magic Bullet blender for smoothies. And like, I was like, okay, I've had this thing for 10 plus years. It's getting bad. I think I'm going to buy a new Magic Bullet blender smoothie. So I donated that one. And then the new one was as bad as
The old one after 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, it's like huffing and puffing just to drink some frozen bananas.
But that's also what that George Saunders story feels like, where I'm like, oh, everything has 15 steps.
Yes.
And everything that seems like it should have two steps have like 15 steps in it and like a liability form I have to sign.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%.
And it's exhausting.
It is.
And it's also like, it's crazy making and infuriating. And now I sometimes when I interact with something that makes me feel like I have to do those things, I become really unkind and impatient and sort of like worked up.
Right.
Because it's like, I just want something to be easy. It's not.
Yeah. Yeah. And we were just talking about these Apple Vision goggles and just the amount of wrinkles that's going to add to just
exactly.
the experience.
But that's like exactly the world that he's writing about. And
it
so
is.
Every year I read one of these books and I'm like, this is more true than it was last year.
Right.
And now I'm like, how is satire even possible when like those worlds are being built? I don't know. It's fucking crazy. I think the older I get, the more I move like away from, I'm like, oh, I'm a Luddite.
What's a Luddite?
A Luddite is like, well, it was like a religious group that but now it means somebody who doesn't fuck with technology.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I was a kid, my mom took us to Amish town in Pennsylvania, and I, like, fell in love with this baby cow, and I, like, was begging her to get the cow as our pet. I was like, can't we just drive it to California? But we stayed in an Amish family's bed and breakfast, and it was, like, really fascinating, and it very, I still remember, like, very, resonant in a way.
No
the technology is bad, and that's clear,
but I think a lot of that is reflected in his work, where it's like the way that technology seeps into us and becomes so second nature that we don't even know to have a problem with it, even though we feel we like feel really discombobulated. We're almost like too coddled by technology to know that it's what's making us feel so sick.
Yeah, and that these things that we keep thinking are giving us more time, they aren't. There was like that tweet that was going around. It was like, we used to look at the internet to get away from reality. Now we go to reality to get away from the internet. And it's like so spot on. Yeah.
Yeah. I also think there's a convenience fee.
A convenience fee.
Yeah. I think when somebody, if something is convenient, there's a trade-off. I think a lot of us give away a lot of our privacy so that somebody can be more convenient.
Yeah.
And I think the most obvious example of that is like data mining, where you're like, yeah, I want to use the app. Like, here, have all my data. That's another fucking thing is like everything is like I ordered something online. They told me to track the package. To track the package, I have to download an app. I have to make an account. I had to give them my email, my phone number. By that point, I'm like, I don't even, it'll come when it comes.
That's right.
I'm like, I don't even give a shit when it comes anymore.
You got to opt out of the emails that they immediately put you on because you're on their list. I was talking to this older gentleman the other day, and he was saying he can't wait till you walk into an establishment and they already know who you are because of your face. He said, because he always forgets his credit card. And I was like, really? So, but that's it? You're down? He's like, yeah, I got nothing to hide. I was like,
thumbprint.
Is it about having something to hide or is it about?
No, it's about having a space where they can't advertise to you.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Well, and that's the thing too. They're talking about gambling addiction, how it's so much worse now that all these apps are on your phone. Same goes for shopping. Yes. Like you used to have to go to a mall to go overspend money, which was hard after all the TV ads and billboards and newspaper ads and all the things that were targeting you anyway. But now it's literally on your body or near your body all day long.
The one click.
Yeah. So the fact that we're not all even more in debt than we are, I think, is pretty amazing.
And that's the other thing that's interesting is that everything you need to do takes 15 steps unless it includes buying a product. And then it's as easy as just clicking it and typing in like a password.
Yeah. Yeah. Funny how that works, huh?
Yeah. And when people like do like the, you know how you can pay with your thumbprint in Erewhon?
Yeah.
Every time I see that, I'm like, are you guys stupid? I'm like, has anybody here watched a sci-fi movie?
Yeah.
It just feels like, I'm like, okay, yeah, give Amazon your thumbprint. Fine.
Right. Well, Amazon, I think it's like your hand. It's whatever, your palm, which is like something even more.
I won't even use my face unlock on my phone.
Yeah, no, I won't either.
Yeah, I'm like.
I was at the beach the other day and there's something about this woman. The sun was setting, so everyone's hanging out. And this woman had her palms facing the sunset and she was just standing there. And so then I started doing it and my friend started doing it. And it was like, it felt so good. Like something about the palms are a real vulnerable part of your body of real.
Well, you're absorbing.
Yeah, and you're absorbing through your palms. Yeah. So the fact that like you go to a store and they charge you money through those same palms, it's like, yeah, that's a little.
I'm almost like, is there nothing that can be mine for me?
Right.
Like everything I have from like when you go to the airport and they scan your face, or like the facial recognition software that Amazon is making that they license to the LAPD. I'm like even like. The very like configuration of the things on my face is not mine.
Right.
It's like up for public consumption.
Right.
And can be used against me.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's the cool part about reading George Saunders is once you do, if you're into him, you could call a lot of things in your life George Saunders like.
So many things are Saunders-esque.
God, that's like a George Saunders story.
I tweet that all the time about so many different headlines.
Yeah.
I'm like, this is a George Saunders story.
Yeah, and it makes you feel better. It makes you feel like, hey, there's been other people who've identified this and read it, and we're seeing these patterns and.
But that's what I mean is I feel like people see the patterns and they go, yeah, but isn't it so convenient? Doesn't it make your life easier? Isn't it nice to get something shipped to you overnight?
Yeah, well, it's hard, you know? It's like the same things that make leaving the house hostile, which are all these ads and things being sold to us and the anger of commerce that's existing outside. It does sort of like, soothe you to go, oh, yeah, I'll just click and I don't have to go face that onslaught, when meanwhile it's like, yeah, you know, if there were just places to go be
the death of the third space.
Yeah.
Well, this next George Saunders one is way better. It's this is from his book Civil War Land and Bad Decline, which I actually believe is his first book, and this is the very last passage, and it's actually the author's note. It's not a short story. And it's about how this book was written at his day job between the years of 1989 and 1996. And he is basically talking about how he wrote this horrible, horrible novel that nobody liked. And he was at this awful day job. And he has this quote, and it says, "We build our hours, and I would respond to any disrespect towards my person by declaring, in my mind, always only in my mind, thanks, a-hole, your project has just funded a Saunders grant for the arts." And so anytime he was working on something, he would build him an extra half hour, and then he would use that half hour to work on his book.
Cool.
And it's just sort of such a beautiful passage about what it means to desperately want to make art and still need to make money.
Yeah.
And so he talks about how he worked at this horrible, like, soul-sucking desk job. And then he wrote this awful novel that his wife hated and couldn't tell him that she hated. So she kept being like, it was interesting. And he could tell that it wasn't interesting. And so in a way he broke, and then he started writing these, like, very dark poems. And one day he brings them home and he leaves them on the table, and he comes in later and she's reading them and she's laughing. And that's the first time he realized, like, oh, I was doing the wrong thing.
Right.
Like, instead of, like, a Hemingway-esque novel, I should have been writing short stories.
Right.
And so then that became Civil Warland, this book, which he wrote over the course of, like, 10 years.
Pretty cool to hear.
Yeah, and he would write, and he didn't start until his mid-30s.
Yeah.
Early to mid-30s, and he wrote 2 short stories a year every year for 10 years.
Wow.
And then that became this book, and then one book became another book, and now he has, like, 10 books.
Yeah, and I mean, it just goes to show, like, these creative acts are, like, their sources of rebellion against our work life. It's like, hey, I want to explain and express the world as I've experienced it and hopefully want to share with other people. And, like, I think a lot of people can relate, maybe even listening to this, of sitting at your job and feeling like there's more you want to say and there's more you want to share with people, and knowing that people have blazed a trail before and done it.
Yeah.
It's really easy to get discouraged, I think, about it. The arts are for privileged people, you know, and it's like, yeah, they are, but there are also voices that get through the cracks. And even the ones that don't get through the cracks, it's equally valid that you have these feelings and that you build that company the extra half hour so you can write in your diary or whatever it may be, because I think we all just, when you're creating things, you feel that is closer to the core of why you're here.
Yeah, I think that is a little bit more rewarding. And I also think there's this Instagram account I follow. I think they're called, like, Liberation Art, Earth Liberation Art, something like that. They make very, like, sort of radical art, and they had this one piece about how when you are working in the arts and you think you're an artist, you think you might need to quit your job to pursue your art. But instead, you should find a job that pays you to work on your art. Mm. And so if you can find a job that's just about showing up, if you can be a receptionist, if you can be a security guard, if you could do something where you literally just have to be there and you can work on your art in the meantime, and so they can pay you to do what you want to do. And it's like, I mean, in art, we're so surrounded by kids who just have never had to worry about next month's rent, let alone like worry about next month, your next meal.
Yeah.
And that can be so discouraging, and being like, well, I'm never going to make it if that's what you need. But right. Then this book is like such a miracle that it exists, because, you know, he was like 30, 35. He had 2 young kids, new wife. There's a part in this passage where the car breaks down, and so he has to bike 7 miles in the rain, like, all winter long to get to his job. But he does it anyway because he needs to make money, and still he was able to do the book.
That's so cool.
It's so cool.
That reminds me of a similar story from Ang Lee, the guy who directed Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Same thing. He showed a lot of promise later in life at NYU Film School. Then he's in his 40s. He's the one taking care of the kids, and somehow he makes it all work. And yeah, it's cool to hear those things.
It's really cool. It's like a balm or a salve.
It really is. Yeah, and it's just, you know, the penultimate part of being a creative is not hoping that your stories get found by corporations to publish them. But it is, you know, it's just, yeah, these are like guideposts for all of us.
Yeah, it's like a little bit of hope.
Yeah, a little bit of hope. That's really cool.
I know, which is funny because his books are so hopeless.
Yeah, that's
like,
what I mean.
The stories are so...
And yet the stories of his life are so generous and moving. It's really cool.
I know, it is funny. It's like there's that parable about, like, the really nice man who made very violent art and then the really mean guy who made beautiful, kind paintings.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, that I turn over in my head that question all the time of, like, you know, should we be applying morality to people who create art? Should the people we've deemed bad, should their art just go away, or does it have value? And yeah, it's just an endless thing to think about.
It is sort of like a bottomless conversation, but also I think like a guidepost can be like, okay, well, who's making the money?
Right.
Like if somebody evil is making money because we're watching their thing, maybe we shouldn't watch their thing. Maybe we should just discuss it or torrent it or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Follow the money.
Kind of.
Simple as that.
Okay. I only have two more books.
All right.
We're burning through them. Okay. This next book is such a quick read.
Okay.
Which is why I really like it. It's truly 120 pages. And it's an Angela Davis book. It's called Abolition Democracy, Beyond Empire, Prisons and Torture. And it's actually an interview. And so somebody interviewed her. And it's sort of like the perfect briefer on like demilitarization and abolition. And it takes these really interesting concepts and boils them down. And it also sort of takes a big shot at like neoliberal diversity tactics. It's like sort of the phenomenon of more female prison guards.
Right.
Yeah. Which is really cool. And so there are a few really good quotes in here that I want to talk about. And the first one is, the challenge of the 21st century is not to demand equal opportunity to participate in the machinery of oppression. Rather, it is to identify and dismantle those structures in which racism continues to be embedded.
Yes.
Yeah. And I feel that way with a lot of like sexism stuff where it's like, okay, well, let's have a woman in the military. And it's like, no. And so they in this book, they actually talk about the Abu Ghraib. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah. I mean.
Scandal.
Yeah.
Where famously in the wake of 9/11, you know, there was the war on terror and there were CIA black sites. And it's about how the U.S. would extradite people to countries where they were allowed to torture and they would pay people to torture, you know, prisoners, and so they could say that the U.S. didn't engage in torture.
Yeah, and if you've read any of the stuff in depth about what happened in Abu Ghraib, which, yeah, I don't really know how to pronounce it either, it's like, it's vile.
It's vile, and
it like hurts your belief in humanity.
I do think it like damages like your soul. Yeah. A little bit. And a lot of some parts of this book, she talks about how a lot of the soldiers that were posing with the prisoners of war were women.
Right.
And so she's like, this is a shock to the senses because we were told that, like, including women who are supposed to be soft, who's supposed to be emotional in the machine would soften the machine.
Yeah.
And instead it just hardens the women.
Wow. Yeah, and I mean, that's the whole thing is, like, not only have they there's been this divide and conquer, but then we're just left at this place where we're scratching and clawing for the privilege to be inhumane.
To participate in the machine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like, just scratch it. We're not even getting there where everyone's equally exploited by corporations and all that stuff.
And that's why it's like the neoliberal concept of diversity. It's like, okay, we have more women in the room, but what does that matter if they're making the same decisions the men would make?
Yeah, what room is this? Why are we in this room?
And why that room?
Why can't
that
we
table?
Be in the forest?
You know? I mean, and now we're really getting somewhere. So here's another quote that I think really boils down what the book is. Again, this is such a quick read that I'm like, I found it sort of like a really necessary explainer.
Yeah, no, like, I want to read this
like,
already.
You can have my copy if you want.
I couldn't.
I mean, I'd take it back from you.
Oh, okay. Deal end. All right.
So this one says, in thinking specifically about the abolition of prisons, using the approach of abolition democracy, we would propose the creation of an array of social institutions that would begin to solve the social problems that set people on the track to prison, thereby helping render prison obsolete. Yeah. So it's the idea of, like, I guess W.E.B. Du Bois, abolition democracy is his concept, and it's the idea that, like, okay, after the abolition of slavery, there needs to be a building of a different building of systems, and if those systems don't exist, then it's not a democracy. So it's like, okay, the military industrial complex, the prison industrial complex, any sort of equalizer that would mean any opportunities that people experiencing slavery didn't get to have, there must now be systems that can set them right.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's the great challenge that we're all that some of us were kind of, as you look at the world you're living in, how could you improve it? And how can you build alternative ways of approaching it? And I just think we should all just meet up at the public parks and just talk Like, we got to start there. Let's just go talk and hope that we don't get hit with loitering.
Well, dude, I absolutely. That's like the whole thing is like.
Like, how do we just talk to each other again, you know?
But I think that so many of these things exist so that people don't talk to each other, because it's like there's actually use in prisons, because prisons mean cheap labor.
Right.
And if there's cheap labor, then corporations can please their shareholders. And it's like the systems exist as they do for a reason, because it's making a lot of people money. And we just happen to not be those people.
Yeah. Yeah. And by a lot of people, we're talking like 10% of people own 90% of the stock market.
Dude, kind of the, so insane.
Do these things just like plague your thoughts on a daily basis?
They used to, and then I realized that wasn't helping anybody. Okay. So now I'm a little bit more of a blissful idiot. But nice. Like books like this really make you sit down and think about it. And there's also, I think that you have to know that there's no chance for you in your life to make those decisions on a big scale that would help everybody.
Yeah.
But there are chances in your personal life.
Yes.
Yeah.
And little ripples from that.
Yeah, or it just makes you feel good and that's enough.
Right.
Yeah, where it's like you don't have to...
It just makes you feel good and that's enough. Yeah.
Yeah.
Scaling it down to that
place. Scaling it way down. I think I used to be like really up in arms about a lot of things, and then I was like, oh, I can just like hang out in my neighborhood and make friends with my neighbors, and that can just be the work that I do.
Yeah. Great. I love that.
But then, I mean, you know, people like Angela Davis were like the big thinkers. I'm like... those are the people I can be paying attention to and like taking note from. And a lot of this book is also about reconceptualizing the idea of security, which is a thing I really like. And I think we talk a lot about in Los Angeles about like, just do we feel safe here? Like cleaning up the streets, you know, city beautification projects. And I'm sort of like, I feel like that conversation is so dangerous if it's not paired with like who we find dangerous and why, and like what are the things that we can do to keep those people out of danger.
Yes.
Like the people who end up being dangerous people, what was the path that they sent on? What were the social services that they lacked? Like,
yeah. And it all comes down to like our intentions, right? Like, what do we value as a society and how do we intend to fix that? And yeah, just, I don't know, I get discouraged because it feels like often it's like, yeah, it's the marketplace. And so all the answers are sort of geared in that way, but you know.
Yeah, I think exactly. And that's sort of like, there's no like unsuturing any of it, but it's also so depressing to meet people who like refuse to believe that a better world is possible.
Yeah, true.
And they're true. Sort of just like.
I know.
Defeatist or.
I know. Well, my most controversial video I ever released was about how I think the people who are having kids are actually like not boring at all. They're actually like kind of brave and they're being optimistic and they're
so optimistic.
Putting forth they're putting forth the
brave.
People who could fix the world, you know? And so
I mean, that's a heavy burden to put on the kids, but yeah.
Yeah, okay, but you know, it might coexist in it a little more peacefully than we have.
It's also people who have who clearly believe in a future one way or the other.
Yeah, exactly. And so there it is. And so it looks like your final book is someone who I think might be, yeah, to me, is like the great American novelist or something.
I would agree that she is the great. This is one of the first books that got me like really into books. I read this book when I was like maybe in eighth or ninth grade. This is Sula by Toni Morrison. And it's this really, have you ever read this book?
I read all of her books in a stream. And so I'm like
together.
Racking my brain. I've read
That's
Beloved. I've read Songs of Solomon.
George Saunders.
With George Saunders.
Where
yeah.
I read them all like
so it's like you almost take it in as one body.
Yeah.
But I don't think I have.
Well, it's really beautiful. It's about friendship and womanhood and it's about growing up and like it's about two women who grow up in the same sort of derelict small town and one becomes like the matriarch of the town and the other becomes the pariah. And it's about their friendship through that and like surviving it or not surviving it, and it is really just it's just really, really beautiful and like very lovely and obviously written so beautifully. She's so talented. But there's this closing line, and it's like my favorite closing line in any book. And it's the quote is, "It was a fine cry, long and loud, but it had no bottom and no top, just circles and circles of sorrow." I'm like, okay, bars.
Yeah. You're just
so
going to drop that on us and go?
But yeah, but it's about like grief and loss and growth and how like there's no one without the other. And
I love that.
So good.
Yeah, I love that. I love it as like a closing thought for our conversation and just the idea that, yeah, life goes on and the pain is inherent in it. And it's,
yeah,
it's also the beauty and the exaltation.
Yeah.
Profound. As was this conversation.
So good.
Yeah, I feel like we really got into some cool territories. Yeah, blew through some books. I'm really grateful you came on. I love all your choices here. And it just made me curious to read them. I definitely want to read the Angela Davis one.
Yeah, I'll give this one to you. I did mark this up. And so if you see that I underlined something stupid, I need you to be nice.
Keep it. Yeah. Yeah, I can't.
You can't risk that?
Okay, I'll take it.
It's good. It's also so quick that I'm like, that's an afternoon read.
Yeah.
And it gives you so many big things to think about.
Well, Ellery Smith, thank you so much
for
joining us.
Thank you for having me. This was so fun. I love the concept.
Okay, good.
I can't wait to listen to them all.
Yeah, me too. This was great. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Turek Books Podcast.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Turek Books. Be sure to like, subscribe, thumbs up, any kind of thing that could help us get listened to or watched by more people. We really appreciated having you and hope to see you again next week with a new guest and plenty of books. Take care until then.